We're going to go ahead and get started. I'd like to welcome you all out. I'm Robert Burns, the chair of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. We'll go ahead and we'll start with introductions. Jim?
I'm Jim Gaskill from South Weber. I'm at-large representative.
Paul Cowley, representing the Forest Service.
Craig Van Tassel from Camas, sportsman.
John Blazard from Camas, representing agriculture.
I'm Joel Ferry from right here in beautiful Brigham City, representing agriculture.
Lynn Nelson, elected official.
Bryce Thurgood Perry, and public at large.
John Wall, Riverdale, public at large.
R. Jeffrey Hicks, at large.
John Cabot, Hooper, and non-consumptive.
And I'm Justin Doling, with regional supervisor, and I serve as the executive secretary and non-voting member of the council.
Bruce, would you introduce yourself?
Thank you. Bruce Soloto, Bureau of Land Management.
Thank you. In addition, we have two members that are excused tonight, Chris Purdy and John Leonard. Again, I'm Robert Burns. I represent the public at large. If you would all join me in turning off your phones or turning down your ringers, we could have an uninterrupted meeting. If I can get my phone to unlock here, there we go. The purpose of the RAC is to gather input from the public concerning wildlife management policy rules and regulations. The council then makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board sets policy for all protected wildlife in Utah. When speaking tonight, please be sure you speak loudly into the microphone. We're still having some trouble with the transcription volume. When I go back and look over the minutes and listen to it, it's pretty low. So luckily I have some headphones I can put on with the volume turned way up. Our standard operating procedure, we'll have a presentation from the division, then we'll have questions from the public, then we'll have questions from the RAC, then we'll have comments from the public. If you wish to comment on a agenda item, please fill out a blue card, pass that up, then we'll know to call you. After the comments from the public, we'll shut that agenda item off to the public's involvement. We'll have comments from the RAC, then motions, deliberations, and we'll vote on a motion. With that, hopefully you all received the minutes from the December 5th meeting. Or no, that was the Wildlife Board's meeting. What was it? December 4th? Are there any amendments to the minutes of the December 4th meeting? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
I'd move that we approve the minutes of the December 4th meeting.
Second.
We have a motion from Paul Cowley and a second from Jim Gaskill to approve the minutes of the December 4th Northern Regional Advisory Council meeting. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. I don't believe we have any changes to the agenda. Okay, so chair would entertain a motion to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting.
We did get some changes
to the information
to
in
the content, but yes. not to the agenda.
Correct. Yes.
Okay, I'll make a motion that we approve the agenda.
Second.
Joel.
I did not.
John. Okay. We have a motion from Jim Gaskill and a second from John Blazard to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. All in favor? Please raise your hand and say aye. It's unanimous. We We have two Wildlife Board meeting updates because there was Wildlife Board meeting the day after our last meeting, and then there was Wildlife Board meeting in January for that December RAC meeting. So in general, the Wildlife Board did follow the recommendations we made to them. There are a few changes on the there was a motion that the Monroe unit spike hunt would be primitive weapon only. That passed unanimously. There was a motion to keep the extended archery bull elk hunt in the San Pete Valley, and that also passed unanimously. That was on the December 5th Wildlife Board meeting. On the January Wildlife Board meeting, this is the 9th of January, the difference between what we had recommended and what the Wildlife Board approved on the Cougar Rule amendments, the Wildlife Board approved the Cougar Rule amendments as presented by the division at the RAC meetings, with the understanding that the depredation is not included in the harvest objective. The division will present a progress report every 3 years to the Wildlife Board in conjunction with the Cougar recommendations. So, and the Wildlife Board expects to, in that report, to see how many of those depredation tags were issued and what the outcome of those were. So. That's the only real difference on the January 9th meeting. Are there any questions? Seeing none, we'll go to the regional update.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go over the different activities that are going on in our sections here in the northern region. I'll start out with wildlife. Our wildlife biologists are busy in the process of conducting pronghorn flights in Rich County and also in West Box Elder County. They're also working with the other sections to conduct to finish up our sage grouse and sharp-tailed lek counts. And if anybody on the RAC has an interest in going out and participating in one of those counts, please contact Darren DeBlois. He can get you linked up. And then the last thing in the wildlife section is our guys will be gearing up to do our spring range assessments, where we go out and look at the condition of the winter range and see how well it dealt with the browsing by the big game species throughout the winter. In our habitat section, I'm pleased to announce that our sportsman organizations funded over $1.6 million worth of projects, habitat projects statewide, and a fair number of those projects are here in the northern region. So our hats off to the sportsman organizations for coming forward and providing that kind of a funding base. Some of the big projects we got planned here in the northern region, we want to do to 3,000 to 4,000 acres of pinyon juniper thinning and removal in West Box Elder County. We have plans to plant about 5,000 bare root shrubs up in our Bud Phelps Wildlife Management Area. And then on the Weeks property, which is a Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife property in Cache Valley, we also have plans to plant about 1,000 bitterbrush and sagebrush seedlings with the help of the sportsmen. And then on the Hogup Mountains, we have plans for installing 10 new guzzlers this spring and summer. In our outreach section, the community fishing club events are starting to crank up. We've got about 12 community fisheries here in the region, and we go out and meet with those communities every year and do these fishing club efforts. We also have a watchable wildlife viewing event coming up for sage grouse on the East Canyon Divide. They're just north of East Canyon Reservoir. That's a watchable wildlife event to look at strutting sage grouse. And then there's a big cleanup effort up at Hardware Ranch coming up later in the spring, and that effort's being funded by Comcast. So any details on that, please contact our Brad Hunt, who's our wildlife manager up there at Hardware. In our aquatic section, there's kind of a unique population of fluvial cutthroat in the Weber River, and our biologists are continuing to study that population of fish. They're a larger fish that spend most of their time in the main stem of the Weber, but during the spring spawn will head up these very small tributaries, and these fluvial cutthroat are running about 18 to 20 inches in length, and the biologists continue to look at what tributaries are being used and what kind of barriers may exist to impede the movement of these fluvial cutthroat. So that project's continuing. Fishing right now is really heating up on our lakes and rivers throughout the region. And if you like to fish for wipers, I understand right now that Willard Bay is extremely hot fishing for wipers. So get out there and catch those big boys. In our law enforcement section, we've had a fair number of personnel changes I just wanted to go over. We have a new officer in Davis County. Her name is Crystal Tucker. We have a new officer in Rich County. His name is John Owen. We have a new officer in Weber County. His name is Devin Christensen. And we have a new officer in Summit County by the name of Brent Kaza. And then we've had three recent promotions within the section. Brandon Barron is now the new sergeant over Cache and Box Elder counties. Rustin Nilsson is the sergeant, the E sergeant over Morgan, Summit, and Rich County. And Mitch Lane is our new lieutenant, replacing Scott Davis. So currently our law enforcement section, we're still two officers short, but we're doing much better today than we did a year ago today. So that's all the update I have, unless there's any questions. Robert asked about our big game transplants. You know, we had a busy winter, and I guess I tend to forget that we don't meet as a group during the winter, but we had transplants of bighorn sheep off of the Newfoundland Mountains and Antelope Island. We also transplanted mule deer off of Antelope Island, about 100 does, and moved them to the Oak Creeks and, I believe, Elk Ridge down in Monticello. We also had our mountain goat transplant from Willard, and those animals, I'm not sure where they went. Can you help me there, Randy? Okay. And I think that covers all our big game transplant. It was a real busy winter for us transplanting big game, and we've got a couple of projects that are being planned for this coming winter period as well. So,
thank you, Justin. With that, we'll go to item number 5, R657-45, Wildlife License Permit and COR Forms Rule Amendment.
All right, good evening. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Phil Gray. I'm the business analyst with the division out of the Salt Lake office, and tonight I will be presenting our recommendations for a few different items. The first up is going to be R657-45-3, the license permits and rule amendments. First off, a little background. Last summer, Kenny Johnson came with a proposal that was going to the state legislature to do some fee changes, modify the statute a little bit as to what the RAC and board can approve and what's set in statute. So we made some fee changes. We made some changes to the statute that allow us a little more flexibility in what licenses we can and can't create. First off, what really drove this is Since the inception of the 365-day hunting license, fishing license, combination license, we've had a lot of positive feedback. People like that a lot, but we invariably kept getting the question of, can't we get longer than a year? The argument was always made of, my driver's license is good for 5 years, but I got to renew my fishing license every single year. So we went to the legislature. We asked him to remove the mention of 365 from statute, and in doing so, they gave the RAC and the board the authority to set license terms at our level instead of at the legislature level. So what we did is the 360-day formats remained the same. So a single-year license is still valid for 365 days from the date of purchase. We are proposing to allow multiple-year purchases for hunting, fishing, and combination licenses. These licenses will be available in one, two, three, 4, and 5 year increments. There will be a dollar discount per year for each additional year that's purchased up front. As well, the other thing we're doing is it's a little difficult to explain. We're basically offering a license extension. So say you go into an office, your license, you know, you're buying your deer tag, your turkey tag right now, and your combination license is up in a month or a week or 6 weeks. And if you were to buy a new combination license now, that 6 weeks is pretty much gone. The original license has been overwritten with the new one, which starts 365 from now. So what we're proposing is an extension license to where you will be able to renew your license early within 6 months of the expiration date and not lose any field days. So you would get a new document that basically starts today and then is valid for whatever period you've elected to purchase from the expiration date of your original license. So let's say your license expires in a week. You go in to buy a year. Your new license will start now and be valid now, and then expire 1 year and 1 week from now. And the last thing we're doing is we are dropping the one-day fishing license, and we're going to be offering a 3- and 7-day fishing license and keep a 3-day non-resident hunting license. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Are there any questions from the public on Phil's presentation? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions from the council on Phil's presentation? Jim.
I notice in number 2, it says that the multi-year fishing, hunting, and combination licenses are available only at the resident and non-resident fee rates prescribed for adults and not at the discount rates offered to youth, seniors, or veterans. And I'd like an explanation for that.
There was some discussion about youth. I don't remember the specific discussion about seniors and veterans, but it was just decided that in order to provide this, we need to have some kind of cutoff line where it's going to be. So youth and seniors and veterans will still get their rate at the single year, but they would still have to renew them year after year.
Why? What's the rationale?
I honestly couldn't answer that. I either wasn't in those meetings or I wasn't privy to them. A lot of this rule was written before I got my current position. I apologize. I definitely can't get an answer for you as soon as I can talk to Kenny.
Okay. Then I'm wondering about this under number 4C. I'm wondering about the handling fee. Is that something that is just in case, or is that something that is, you have a number already in mind you're going to charge?
Right. What that's referring to is up in section 5.
5C.
Right. So
I'm sorry, 5C.
Right. So Section 5 states that anybody that's a current resident that then moves outside of the state of Utah. So let's say you go and buy a 5-year license. In 2 weeks, you move outside the state of Utah. If you buy another license in another state as a resident in that state, your license in Utah is invalid, and you're actually in violation in both states. So we didn't want to set it up to where somebody would be walking into a criminal offense by having a resident license in two states. So what we've provided in Section 5 there is, if you move out of the state, contact the division, and we will change your license from a resident to a non-resident license, which is still valid for whatever period you bought it.
Yeah, I understand that, and I have another question about that in a second. But my question was that the division may charge a handling fee.
Right.
I'm wondering what that's going to be and how much it's
going to
be.
Right now, it's not going to be. It's something that we were asked by the legislature to keep an eye on if it gets out of hand. If it becomes a point to where there's one person doing this full time, then they wanted us to be collecting some money for it to make up for that. But as it stands now, we don't see it being a huge problem. We don't see it really being a problem at all. As those come up, we'll take care of them. It's a really quick and easy fix. So right now, there is not going to be a handling fee, but we did want to put it in the rule to address it.
And that won't
become an issue.
So that won't have to go through a legislature.
No, there's already a handling fee established in the fee schedule, a $10 fee.
Okay, that was $10.
Okay, I'm sorry, $10 if we decide to do it. But
okay,
we're not, at this point, we're not going to.
Now, if you get a non-resident license because you've moved to a new state, then you would be subject to non-resident tag fees. Is that correct?
Correct.
So you buy a 5-year license, but it's only you couldn't put in as a resident.
No.
If you don't buy a resident license in the other state, then what? So I moved to California. I'm not going to buy a hunting license in California. I've got my 5-year license. It's a resident license because I haven't applied for the exception. How's that going
to
work?
There's actually two parts to the residency requirement. The first states that you have to be a resident and have your primary domicile in Utah for 6 months immediately prior to purchasing a license, and not have a hunting or claim residency in another state for the purposes of hunting and fishing. So if you're not actually living in Utah for the 6 months prior to the purchase of a license and you claim residency, you're actually in violation of the residency rule.
But I'm not buying a license. I've already got one.
Okay, so let's say you have your combination license.
Right.
As long as all you're doing is using the rights to that combination license, there won't be an issue. I don't think there'd be any officer that would really push that issue. But if you applied for or obtained some other tag using that combination license as a prerequisite, then you would be in trouble.
Okay, we better do a pretty good job of advertising that.
We will.
It's a little
tricky. We have plans in place for that.
Okay, thank you.
Any additional questions from the council?
I know Paul. One of the things that was brought up when this was first introduced is a concern that you may get a large chunk of money as people go to a 5-year license, and then are those funds going to be carried year to year as needed by the division to have an equal budget like the 1-year license does now?
From my understanding of it, yes. They've got some. The fiscal section has a rudimentary plan in place to start identifying those funds that are supposed to be spread out over 5 years instead of 1 year. I know talking with Kenny just a few days ago, he does have a plan for identifying that, especially identifying that to the director's office so we don't get all excited to this huge influx of funds in the first year and then be broke next year.
Okay, so, thank you.
Yes.
Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none. I have no blue comment cards. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to comment on this agenda item? Okay, seeing none, we'll go to the council. Comments from the council? Jeffrey. Okay.
So my comment is that I think it's a great idea to give a multi-year ability to purchase a license. And if I understand correctly, I really like the idea of being able to buy it whenever you want, and it works retroactive from the date of your license. I say this because the people that I know that hunt and fish with me, including myself, we might all be knuckleheads, but none of us have any idea when our license expires. Since they switched this over from the end of the year, I have no idea when my license expires. Every fall, I kind of look it up and try to figure and figure it out. So
nobody does.
I know. It's a silly thing that was ever done. But anyway, that being aside, I like the idea that you can buy multi-years, and at least for 5 years, I don't have to worry about trying to figure out when my license expires.
You still have to have it with you, though. Remember that.
I do have.
You still have to have it with you when you're in the field.
Oh, now you're pushing it.
John?
I agree. I think this is a great idea. And I'd encourage the Wildlife Board as well as the DWR to consider including in that five-year license and CORs banding permits, because the federal government has certainly a five-year banding permit, and the state requires that I renew every year. So I think it's a great idea. I know that banders don't have the same constituency as fishermen and hunters do, but certainly it would be a good idea to look at other ways that the COR could be included as well.
Yeah, that's something that wasn't even thought of, so thank you.
Additional comments from the council? John?
I like the program. My only comment is I don't know whether it's too late in the program now to be able to protect the discounted rate for youth.
What do you mean, protect the discounted rate?
Well, right now the youth buy a license at a discounted rate, mm-hmm. but I understand under this rule that will go away.
For the multi-year licenses. We've actually done a lot more for youth in this one than we had in the past. So if a youth wanted to buy a combination license.
But what about seniors and veterans?
We've added more in there for that, too. Okay. We've lowered the veteran fishing license. I can tell you exactly what it's going to be.
But they just have to go year to year, right?
Right, yeah. The veteran license went from $21 a year to $12 a year. Youth under 13 could buy a separate hunting and fishing license. The total cost was, I think, $13. That remains the same. But youth anywhere between 14 and 18, if you wanted a combination license, you had to buy a combination license at the adult rate. There is now a youth combination license. It's only valid for 1 year. It's $16 for a youth combination license.
I remember that.
So, yeah, we have actually built in more stuff for youth and changed a lot of the fees for seniors and veterans that are more appropriate, we feel. But those are actually set in statute in the fee schedule. We can't change those at our level.
Any additional comments from the council? Chair would entertain a motion.
I'd like to make a motion that we approve, Rule 657-45 as presented.
Second.
We have a motion from Joel Ferry and a second by Bryce Thurgood to recommend the Wildlife Board approve R657-45 Wildlife License Permit and COR Forms Rule Amendment. Any discussion on the motion?
Well, given that we haven't any explanation for why we would do away with the discounts for seniors and veterans, I would oppose this bill, this motion, unless we can amend it to include veterans and senior discounts in the multi-year licenses. I don't understand why I can buy a license for 1 year at one rate and then not get that rate for a multi-year. It doesn't make any sense to me, and I think it's a disincentive for anybody to go with the 5 years. Why should I spend the extra money to go with 5 years? I can, in fact, figure out when my license expires.
You can?
Yes, I can.
And see, that's why the seniors don't need the 5 year
rule. He just contradicted himself.
I'm just kidding. Would you like to make an amendment to the motion?
I would.
Absolutely, sure. I agree. I mean, I think that I can understand the youth side, but seniors, once you're a senior, you're always a senior. Once you're a veteran, you're always a veteran. And so that doesn't change. I can understand that, absolutely.
I think the division would have to make sure that in the rule, they would have some language about when you weren't a youth anymore, even if you bought a five-year license.
Well, I don't. Can I make a comment? I apologize. I was just looking at the rule there as it's written. Let me get back to that line. And that qualification, where'd I go here? Never mind.
I mean, we don't know the reasoning that the division decided not to include seniors and veterans, but they obviously they have some reason for that. We're not privy to that information. It's not being shared with us, and so I think if we make a or Jim, if you'd like to make an amendment to my motion, or Paul, if you'd like to.
Yeah, I would recommend that we amend the proposal so that under R-657-45-3, item number 2, seniors or veterans would be eliminated from that group so that they could also obtain at a discount rate the multi-year license. I understand the youth side of it, but the senior and veteran doesn't make sense on my side.
I wonder if they excluded those because they are a discounted rate. I mean, that's what that's saying.
Sorry.
If the maker of the motion and the person seconding it are agreeable, then we'll just include that in the original motion.
You okay with that, Bryce?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll just try to read the modified motion. We recommend the Wildlife Board approve R-657-45 Wildlife License Permit and COR Forms Rule Amendment with the inclusion of deleting from -3.2 seniors and veterans. The intention would be to allow those groups to buy multi-year licenses at the discounted rate.
At the discounted rate.
Yeah. Thank you.
Additional discussion on the motion. Seeing none, I'll call.
Just a comment. Currently, as it's written, they do have the option to purchase those licenses, a five-year license at the regular rate, just not at the discounted rate.
And they would get $1 off per year, I believe.
Correct.
Phil stated. But it wouldn't be the rate that they would typically get.
It wouldn't be the veteran rate or the senior rate.
Correct,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. That's just for clarification as I read it.
So, any additional discussion on the motion? Call for a vote. All in favor, say aye. Please raise your hands.
Aye.
It's unanimous. And Phil, you're going to do these three administrative rules, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So now we'll go to R-657-67, Utah Hunter Mentoring Program Rule and Amendment.
All right. A few months ago, we brought out our hunting mentor program, which will allow a holder of a big game permit to share that license with a qualifying youth. The RAC and board approved this. We've had a lot of support and a lot of interest in this program. As we started looking at it and figuring out a way to make the program actually work in a practical means, we realized that the rule kind of tied our hands a little bit. The current rule says that any application for the mentor program must be submitted to the division 10 days prior before the start of the desired activity. If somebody wanted to, say, take their son out on an elk hunt, they went out for the weekend, son hated it, they wanted to take a different son out the next day, they wouldn't be able to do that. They would have to turn in the original authorization, submit another application, and then wait 10 days before that would be valid. We started thinking about it when we have 10-day deer hunts, which this program is kind of designed for. That's not going to work. So if you wanted to mentor one child the first weekend and a different child the second weekend, under the current law, we wouldn't be able to. So we're asking to remove the 10 days, and we've put language in the application process to just allow sufficient time for processing. We're also setting this program up to where it can be handled at the regional office. It doesn't have to be done through the Salt Lake office.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the public on this presentation? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions from the council on this presentation? Jim.
Yeah, just a clarification, because I'm not sure I understand exactly what the legislature did with the not requiring hunter safety. Does that have any effect whatsoever on this mentoring program?
What he's referring to is the trial hunting authorization.
Correct.
That's still a program that will actually be presented to the RACs next month and then go to the board in the following board meeting, what that will actually do. But basically what it is, just a quick summary, is it will give somebody basically a three-year waiver to hunter education. So if they wanted to try hunting without investing the time of doing the hunter education, they do a brief online course, and they have to go out with somebody else who has completed hunter education. Now, that could be anybody. Say, if I had never taken hunter ed, never gone hunting in my life, and you wanted to take me, I could get this authorization, buy a combination license, and then go out hunting pheasants or ducks with you the next day. The mentor program, say you have a big game tag, your minor child does not, and they want to go hunting with you, you apply for this program, the child gets an authorization, you both get to carry a weapon in the field. You still retain ownership of the tag, but you still only take one animal, regardless of who shoots it. And that's what we're referring to here in this presentation. The trial hunting authorization, the way that we will be presenting it next month, is a minor child that doesn't have hunter education yet can apply for and get the trial authorization and then be mentored under their parent's permit.
Okay, that was my question. It was, would the... The 10 days wouldn't have any effect, and we could still,
no. Yeah,
we could pull off
and that's
two grandchildren.
That's actually what prompted all this is when we started putting feet on the ground and trying to figure out how these programs are going to work and realized that this could actually happen and probably will happen, then we realized that 10 days, that's going to make a lot of people angry. So we're fixing it.
Yeah, and I'm in favor of that.
Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we'll go to the public. I have no blue cards on this agenda item. Is there anyone from the public who would wish to comment on this topic? Okay, we'll go back to the council. Comments from the council? Motions from the council?
I move that we accept, that we recommend acceptance of the changes to administrative rule R657-67 Utah Hunter Mentoring Program.
We have a motion from Jim Gaskell and a second from Paul Calley to recommend the Wildlife Board approve R657-67 Utah Hunter Mentoring Program Rule Amendment. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
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 It's unanimous. Now we'll go to R657-13-7, fishing with more than one pole rule amendment. Phil?
All right, this, what this was is it's presented again last summer. The legislature was all behind this. They were in favor of it. The RAC seemed in favor of it. So what we have done is we have removed all instances of second pole permit from the rule. So now anybody that has any license, any fishing license that conveys fishing privileges will automatically have second pole privileges. Anybody that has a fishing license can use a second pole now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good presentation.
Any questions?
That's the guy that keeps turning the lights on and off. Sorry.
Do we have any questions from the public on this topic? Seeing none, we'll go with the council. Questions from the council? Jim?
Yeah, so that will that will take place at some time this year, right?
July 1st.
But my second pole license doesn't expire, and do I get a refund? Or,
Good try.
Yeah, it was worth a shot.
But the upshot of that is anybody that currently doesn't have a second pole permit, that their combination or fishing license expires after July 1st, will be grandfathered in, automatically get.
So if I didn't have a second pole permit on July 1st, I would?
Right.
Okay.
Any additional questions from the council?
How are you going to handle interstate waters like Bear Lake and
those are mentioned in there. I'll have to pull it up to remember exactly. I know Bear Lake, it basically said a holder of valid Utah or Idaho fishing license or combination license may fish within Bear Lake. An individual may fish with up to two poles anywhere in the Utah portion of Bear Lake. So if you have an Idaho license, we're going to let you fish with two poles on our side. On the Idaho side, you still have to follow their rules. Same with the gorge.
Fish on Utah side.
Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none, I have no blue cards for this topic. Is there anyone from the public that would like to comment? We'll go back to the council. Comments and or motions from the council?
I'd like to make a motion that we approve Rule R657-13 as presented.
Second.
I've got a second from John Cabot at a low volume, away from his microphone.
I second.
Thanks, John.
Okay, we have a motion from Joel Ferry and a second by John Cabot to recommend the Wildlife Board approve our 657-13-7 fishing with more than one pole rule amendment. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll go to a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
Unanimous. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
We'll now go to R657-60, Aquatic Invasive Species Interdiction Rule Amendment.
Chairman. My name is Sarah Siegert. I'm the aquatic invasive species biologist in Ogden in the northern region.
Sarah, could you get the microphone a little closer to you possibly? Or
yes, is this better?
Yes, thank
you. All right.
And your name was Sarah?
Siegert.
Siegert.
S-E-E-G-E-R-T. And I'm here to present a proposed rule change to R657-60, the Aquatic Invasive Species Interdiction Rule. So, during the 2014 legislative session, State Senator Peter Knudsen and State Representative Mel Brown sponsored a change to the AIS Interdiction Act to enhance the ability of the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources to protect the state from invasive quagga mussels. So, basically, the legislature approved the change that allows the UDWR to establish non-law enforcement inspection stations along the roadways with a Class B misdemeanor as a penalty for not stopping if you're towing a boat. The intent of allowing these inspection stations is to stop boats that could potentially be transporting mussels in either the adult or veliger stage before they actually reach a water body, and thus reducing the risk of invasions occurring at new locations. By providing the authority to stop boaters along the roadway, we can also shape our program to look a little more similar to surrounding states and provide that continuity to boaters that go between the states and boat in different waters in different states, such as Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana. And So previously, any checkpoints that we had had to be a law enforcement administrative checkpoint. And this gives us the ability to set up checkpoints without having to go through law enforcement. And as always, when the legislature passes a rule, we have to define how that rule will be implemented by the DWR. And so basically the rule states that inspection stations will be placed along the road where there's a high likelihood that will stop boats carrying mussels. They have to be in a safe location that's adequately signed so they're not congesting traffic and putting our technicians or travelers in danger. And the big part of it is that we can verify that decontamination has been started or completed. In the state of Utah, it's required to, boaters are required to decontaminate their boats after boating on a water body that's classified as suspect, detected, or infested, as we defined in the last time you guys met. And so we encourage everybody to complete that by cleaning, draining, and drying their boats for the defined dry period, or getting a professional decontamination with a hot water pressure washer. And basically at these checkpoints, what we'll be doing is we'll be able to verify that the boats have at least been drained and cleaned, and we'll be able to then also indicate when the dry time and decontamination will be completed. And to do that, any boats that come through that have been on an infested water will be tagged that they've been drained and cleaned with a date saying that when that decontamination will be completed, and they won't be able to launch. It'll basically, the wire will attach to the boat to the trailer, so they won't be able to launch without breaking that seal. And any other inspectors at a future, you know, at their destination or any of our partners will then be able to tell whether or not that decontamination has been completed, and we'll be able to provide the professional decontaminations to anybody who plans to launch before the end of the dry time. Currently, we are in the planning stages for the budget necessary to implement these inspection stations and the locations for the 2014 boating season. We're working with in partnership with the National Park Service at the Glen Canyon National Recreation Area in Lake Powell. And there may be some inspection stations as boaters leave the lake, such as on Highway 95 or Highway 89, catching people as they leave Lake Powell, so because Lake Powell is now infested, and that way we'll be able to catch these boats before they reach all of the other waters in the state. We're also actually pretty heavily into the planning process for two checkpoints around Bear Lake. Bear Lake is pretty complicated from an invasive species perspective because there are so many access points to the lake, and we are planning on having two checkpoints set up, one in Garden City coming out of Logan Canyon and one on Highway 16 in Lake Town. And the planning, they're in the planning process. Hopefully we'll get them started even a little bit before the beginning of the fiscal year. And with that, thank you, and if you have any questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the public on the presentation? Seeing none, I'll go to the council. Questions on the presentation? Jeff.
I have a question about those the seals that you put on. So if you fail, they seal you up, they wire your boat to the trailer, am I right? Is that what it is, the seal, decontamination seal?
It's not if you fail the inspection. If you fail the inspection, whoever is doing it will make sure you drain your boat. So if you haven't drained the water yet, you will be required to. And then once we've verified that all the water has been drained, then we'll seal it just because it hasn't undergone the dry time, and will somehow indicate what date you will be considered decontaminated.
So I was just wondering if Is there a penalty, or is there any way to enforce it if you just go around the corner and snip the wire and take it off and go ahead and go? How would you enforce that, what I'm wondering?
It's not easily enforced, but it's the same way that we enforce all of the rest of the invasive species program. You're required to decontaminate, and if and you will be entered into it. We collect data on everybody that we check.
They will be required to be decontaminated before they launch at another reservoir.
Right. Yes. So if they can't verify that they have been decontaminated at when they are inspected before they launch, then there could be penalties. I forgot to mention, as along with the seal, you would get a receipt with the seal saying that, so you have to have the seal and the receipt saying that you had been inspected, and that was the date of the inspection and when you would be considered decontaminated.
Jim.
So this is only going to be for checkpoints. You don't have any intention of pulling someone over on the highway and checking their boat?
That's correct. We don't have the authority to pull people over, but this we will set up signs, and it will be required to stop at the specific spot of the checkpoint.
And you're not going to have law enforcement there?
They won't always be there, but we will be working with law enforcement and making sure that somebody is at least in the area to be called in if we have any sort of infraction.
Yeah, I'd strongly recommend that.
Absolutely.
Jeff.
About the checkpoints, are these going to be permanent? Are they temporary? Are they going to move around in places up and down the street? Another question, they have certain hours they're going to keep?
They'll definitely have certain hours. We haven't finished planning all of these, and it's just nice that it gives us the flexibility to put implement check stations at points that make sense, especially if another water would become infested. But the ones, for example, the ones we're planning at Bear Lake, they'll be located in one spot the whole season, and we'll have hours. They'll have regular hours that they're open, and they'll be permanent if it works well and if we get funding for it in the future.
Any additional questions? Okay, we'll go to the public. I have no blue cards on this topic. Is there anyone from the public who'd wish to comment? I see none. Back to the council. Comments and or motions from the council. Jim?
Well, I'm not at all convinced it's going to work, but we've got to do what we can. And so I commend you for coming up with a plan, and we'll just cross our fingers and hope that it works, and I'll make a motion that we approve the the proposal on administrative rule R657-60 as presented.
We have a motion from Jim Gaskill and a second from Paul Calley to recommend the Wildlife Board approve R657-60 aquatic invasive species interdiction rule amendment. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye. Aye.
It's unanimous. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
We'll now go to Bucks and Bulls, Once in a Lifetime, and Antlerless Permit Recommendations for 2014.
All right, thank you. My name is Justin Shannon, and tonight I'm going to present the Bucks Bulls Once in a Lifetime Permit Recommendations for 2014. So to begin, we'll start with mule deer. And what I want to do is present where we are today in relation to general season buck harvest, and then also look over the last 10 years or so. Over the last 10 years, on the x-axis here, you have the year, and on the y, you have the thousands of bucks harvested on general season units. We've varied from about 19,000 bucks to 28,000 bucks or so, and as you can see, the last 2 years, we've averaged over 25,000 bucks harvested on general season units. So the harvest has been up. If you look at fawn production over the last 15 years, you can see we've had our peaks and valleys, especially early 2000s. But over the last 5 years or so, fawn production has been relatively stable between 61 and 65 fawns per 100 does. If you look at buck-to-doe ratio trends over that same time period, we've had our moments where we've hovered around 15 bucks per 100 does, but over the last 2 years, we've been as high as we've ever been at 18 and 19 bucks per 100 does on general season units, which again has been good. So with that background, I want to jump into the deer permit recommendations for general season. This year we're recommending an increase of 200 permits from 84,600 to 84,800. But because we have the 30 units on general season, six of these units we're recommending decreases in permits, 17 no change, and then seven increases. There's a lot on this table, and the next few slides are going to be replicates of this table, so I want to take a minute and go over this. On the far left, you have the unit, the hunt unit for general season, and then the next column is the objective, whether we're managing for 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does or 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does. The next column, the three-year buck-to-doe ratio, this is what we manage to, and if the numbers are highlighted in yellow, it means we're below our management objectives, and if it's in green, it means we're above. Next, we have buck-to-doe ratio trends. This is just an arrow indicating whether we've increased or decreased relative to last year in our buck-to-doe ratio on general season units. And then on the far right, we have the number of permits that we're recommending for this year. And so with that, as you can see, we're recommending decreases in permits on the Beaver and the North Slope units, yet we're recommending increases on the Pine Valley. Again, recommending decreases in permits on the Box Elder from 4,000 to 3,800 and on the Cache from 7,100 to 6,600, but increases on the Southwest Desert and the Zion. And then finally, we're recommending decreases on the South Slope Bonanza Vernal, the West Desert West, and increases on the Monroe, Oker Stansberries, Panguitch Lake, and Wasatch Mountains West. Moving on to premium limited entry, this might be the most complicated big game recommendation we have, and the reason it is because for normal permits, the trophy permits, we manage to an age objective. So what we'd like, when it's all said and done, is 40 to 55% of the bucks harvested to be 5 years or older. And as you can see on the Henrys and the Ponsagant, we're at 72% of the bucks harvested are 5 years or older on the Henrys and 64% on the Ponsagant. So we're exceeding those objectives. But these units, and this is where it kind of gets confusing, is they also have management buck hunts, which means you have to harvest a buck with 3 points or fewer on one side. And those are used to manage or to influence the buck to doe ratio. And so these units, we're managing for 40 to 50 bucks per 100 does. And as you can see on the Henrys, we're at 56 bucks per 100 does. But on the Ponsagant, we're at 44 with a declining trend. And so what does this mean for recommendations? For normal trophy unit permits, we're recommending an increase of 3 from 48 to 51 on the Henrys and an increase of 9 from 135 to 144 on the Ponsagant. For management buck permits, take a look at the bottom table. That's probably the cleanest one. We're recommending an increase of 5 permits on the Henrys and a decrease of 8 permits on the Ponsagant. And then the rest of the deer units, the limited entry units, we manage these for 25 to 35 bucks per 100 does. And as you can see, we're on the far right, our 3-year average. We're below average on the Fillmore, Oak Creek, Dolores Triangle, and the Vernon. and yet we're above on the South Slope Diamond Mountain. So statewide, what we're recommending tonight for limited entry permits is a decrease in 16 from 827 to 811, and the bulk of that cut would be taking place on the West Desert Vernum. The other thing I want to bring to your attention with this table is last November when we met, I think it was November, we talked about splitting the book cliffs into the north and south units during the any weapon hunts, and I just wanted to show what those permit numbers would be, 190 on the north and 66 on the south. Some people like to see how this is broken up into archery, any weapon, and muzzleloader. And as you can see, the bulk of the decreases in permits are taking place on the any weapon portion of the hunts. Moving on to elk, for general season units, the statewide plan calls for general season spike permits to remain at 15,000 as long as hunter success rates are below 20%. And in 2013, the success rate was at 17%. We recommend no change in spike elk permits and keeping that at 15,000. We also recommend no change to the 14,300 any bull permits, the 300 youth any bull permits, and the 20 late youth permits. For limited entry, I wanted to start big, give you the big picture of what we're recommending tonight. We're recommending an increase of 100 permits from 2,742 to 2,842. And if you break it down by hunt category, elk are a little different than deer. We don't manage on a bull to cow ratio like we do a buck to doe ratio. For bulls, it's all on an average age. And so for the 7.5 to 8 year old bulls, we're recommending decreases in permits on every unit except the Plateau, Boulder, Kaparowitz. And as you can see in that middle column, that's because we're under our management objective on all of these except one. And this is a trend that we've followed for several years now. I think in 2011, we were at 419 bull permits in this age category, and every year we've been cutting, and it's been good. We've seen a response, and some of these age trends are reversing. Next units, we have 6.5 to 7 year old units. We have some that are under, some that are over, but when you look at it as a whole, we're recommending a decrease of 2 permits from 403 to 401. On the 5.5 to 6 year old units, this is the bulk of the units in the state. We're recommending an increase of 99 permits, and those increases are being proposed for the Manti, the LaSalles, the Three Corners, Nine Mile Anthro, the Fish Lake, and the Wasatch Mountains. And then finally, for 4.5 to 5 year old units, these units are all over their age objectives, except for the North Cache, and we're recommending increases in permits on all these units, and then a decrease on the North Cache. One thing is, as we were taking this through the public process in the Northeast region, there was a RAC member there that recognized that some of the permits that were in the table were not matching the permits that I just showed on the PowerPoint. And so without sending out a new RAC packet and different things like that, we've updated it here. So for instance, on the Fillmore Pavant, the PowerPoint has always said 60, but when you added up all the permits, it was closer to 64. And those have since been corrected, and they'll be corrected for the Wildlife Board as well. So I just wanted to portray those in case anyone caught those same errors. Moving on to pronghorn. Statewide, we're recommending a decrease in permits of 60 from 841 to 781, and the bulk of those cuts are being proposed for the Parker Mountains. And then for once-in-a-lifetime permits, we're recommending a decrease of moose permits by 4 from 71 to 67, and a decrease in bison permits from 104 to 84. Desert bighorn sheep, we're recommending an increase of 3. Rocky Mountain bighorns, a decrease of 2. And then mountain goats, a decrease from 162 to 108. And that's what I have for bucks, bulls, once in a lifetime. Thank you.
Justin, so those couple bull numbers were not included in the update we received by email, but all the rest of it was included?
Yeah, and I apologize for that. What happened is if we were taking it through the RAC process, those errors were caught. And so instead of sending out having two versions of permit numbers. We figured we'd get through the RAC process. I'd acknowledge them in the PowerPoint, and then the table will be updated for the Wildlife Board meetings.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll go to the public. Do we have questions from the public on the presentation? Okay, council, questions from the council on the presentation? Craig.
Yeah, I have a question on the reduction in the Rocky Mountain goat.
Okay.
Why?
Yeah. Good question. Last year, we got really aggressive with nanny hunts on the Willard and the Tusher units both. And then also we did a bunch of transplants. And so we felt like we'd taken those populations down closer to their objectives. And so we just felt like it was time to back off with those. If you look at permits over time, last year was more the anomaly than this year. So we got aggressive with them, and so we're backing off now. So.
Additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we'll go to the public for comment. I have one blue card, Steve Sorensen.
I decided not to talk here. I think I'd be wasting my time. I'd be wasting my time talking to you guys. It'd be more talking to Justin and these guys afterwards. So that's what I'm gonna do.
All right, thank you. Byron, come on up.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm Byron Bateman, representing Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. I just want to congratulate Justin on the great job he did and stuff like that with this proposal they just put out to the public. And I know there's a lot of thought and a lot of work that went into that. And then I just want to thank all the RAC members, too, for your dedication and time. And there's some new RAC members here tonight. I just want to congratulate them on their new position. We've got some simple requests this year. I think that, like I said, the division's done a good job and narrowed it down, really worked real hard on this proposal for bucks and bulls. We just want to keep the Henrys and the Pontsagant premium deer tags at the same level as 2013, with the exception of the management tags. We'd still like to see the management tags reduced on the Pontsagant, but reduced on the Henrys. The other recommendation we have is to keep the central manti bull elk tags at the 2013 level. So like I said, we're making it very simple, but the Henrys and the Pontsagant are world-class units. We hate to see those, you know, any increase. A 10% increase on those numbers is a very large increase. I know a guy that's turned his tag back in the last 2 years. He's drawn it with archery on the Henry mounts because he's gone down and scouted, and he just hasn't seen the quality of bucks that a lot of people are used to seeing down around the Henrys. So I just ask that we be a little bit conservative on those big quality management, you know, type bucks on the Henrys and the Pontsagant. A week from yesterday, we're going to restart redoing the, you know, the management plan for mule deer and stuff like that. So there's going to be some changes coming down the, you know, the pike that's going to affect those different units. But just keep those at last year's levels instead of increasing them this year if you do that. Thank you.
So on the management deer, you wanted the permit numbers to stay the same?
Well, I'd like to see the Henrys reduced back to 2013 and the Pontsagant take this year's, because it is a reduction this year. They're reducing the number of management tags on the Pontsagant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have any additional? Byron, be sure to hand that in when you, your blue card. Do we have anyone else who'd like to comment on this agenda item from the public? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Comments from the council. Jeffrey.
I don't know. It's more of a question than a comment. Am I too late for that?
No, go ahead and ask him.
I was wondering if you could kind of answer some of the questions that Mr. Bateman brought up about that way. Can you address that, please, for us?
Sure. Yeah, let me go back in the presentation. Okay.
And maybe explain why he feels one way and you feel another.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. So, again, when you look at the trophy permits that he was talking about, that they would like to see stayed at last year's number, here's the permits. Let me get it there. Okay, last year we recommended, or what the Wildlife Board approved was 48 permits on the Henry Mountains and 135 on the Paunsagunt, and we're recommending 51 on the Henrys and 144 on the Paunsagunt. And the reason is, for these permits here, that those two right there, our management plan currently says we need to manage for 40 to 55 bucks per 100 does that have to be 5 years or older. And so when we've taken a look at all the harvested deer that have come in, on the Henry Mountains, 72% of the bucks that are coming in are 5 years or older, and on the Paunsagunt, 64% of the bucks coming in are 5 years or older. And so we had the sideboards of the plan, an upper and lower range, and we're exceeding the upper range. And when we make recommendations to the RACs and the Wildlife Board, our recommendations have to show direction towards getting within the sideboards of those plans. And so that's the justification for us coming with this recommendation tonight. Do you want to go into the management buck permits, or yeah, we can do that as well. Okay, so again, if you look at the lower table, management buck permits are predicated on the buck to doe ratio, and so if the buck to doe ratio is above 50 for a 3-year average, we recommend an increase, and that's what we've done on the Henrys. On the Paunsagunt, though, if you look at the bottom table there, we're at 44 bucks per 100 does. But if you look at the trend where it's 47, 44, and 40, that's concerning to us. And that's why on management buck permits, we recommended an increase of 5 on the Henrys, just because our buck to doe ratio is at 56. But on the Paunsagunt, we don't like that trend. And so we're recommending a decrease of 8 permits on there. And then was it cash, or the Central Mountains Manti for elk? Was that the third one?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so again, on this unit, the Central Mountains Manti, the second one down there, our 3-year average is 6.1, and if you look at the sideboards of the plan, we're supposed to be managing for a 5.5 to 6-year-old bull. That's why we've done a slight increase in permits. And another thing that the region did with this is it was an increase of 23 permits, but they broke up how many of those are going to the early and the late hunts. On the late hunts, we have lower success rates. And so this year they said, let's have 40% of the permits go to the late hunt and only 60 in the early. And in the past, they've had 65 in the early and 35 in the late. So even though it's an increase in permits, we're putting more of those permits in the late season hunt where they have lower success rates. And so we felt like that was a way to, we're slightly above objective, and so we're making a slight increase is probably the best way to explain that recommendation.
Additional questions from the council? Or comments? Actually, we're in comments, aren't we? Yes. So, comments. Chair would entertain a motion.
I move that we accept the recommendations of the division regarding the 2014 big game permits as presented.
Second.
Lynn, was that you and John?
Yeah.
I'll take Lynn this time. We have a motion from Jim Gaskill and a second from Lynn Nielsen to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the bucks and bulls and once-in-a-lifetime and antlerless permit recommendations. Bucks and bulls.
Yeah, I'll have a presentation for the antlers.
All right.
I apologize. I should
have said that. We'll have to make sure that that's two topics. So bucks, bulls, and once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations for 2014. Is that acceptable to the maker of the motion?
Yes.
Okay. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, Chair will call for a vote. Please raise your hand and say aye if you're in favor.
Aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. So, Jody, we're going to have number 10 will be the antlerless permit recommendations, and then number 11 will be antlerless CWMU.
Yeah, Yeah, Mr. Chair, I apologize for that. I should have been more clear when I that I'd split those out just because it muddies the water and stuff. Okay. Tonight I'm going to present the antler list recommendations for the 2014 season. Again, we'll start out with deer. I know I showed this slide in the last one where we look at our fawn production over the last 15 years or so, but one thing I'd really like to highlight is the last 5 years where we've averaged between 61 and 65 fawns per 100 does. And the reason I do, I want to highlight that is I think that tells half the story, the production of our deer herds. And the other half is how are those fawns surviving? And so this is a project that we've been doing statewide for several years now, where we've gone and we've gone to seven or eight different areas. We've captured and radio collared many adults and many fawns on these units. And I know this doesn't have a lot to do with the recommendation process, but I think it's good for the RACs and the public to see how our deer herds are doing. And so that's why I'm presenting it tonight. As you can see, over the last 4 years, our adult survival rates have been high, 84 to 86%, which is average to slightly above average at the 86% level. And then the fawns is a little different. The first 2 years that we started monitoring deer, we had just over 50% survival. So what that means is if we catch these deer in November or December, just over half of the deer that we radio collared are surviving to the next November, December. But the last 2 years have been a little different for us, and it's been closer to 80% fawn survival, which has been really good. And so with that background, I wanted to present where we are statewide. Right now we estimate we're at 333,000 deer statewide, and the target calls for 350,000 deer, and our trend is up. So with that background, I'd like to present the antlerless deer permits, or the doe permits, for 2014. We're recommending an increase of 105 permits. Most of this increase is on the Monroe, Sevier Valley area, where they have a lot of resident deer that are causing damage to agricultural crops, and so they want to use public harvest, public hunters to target these deer. But other than that, no new hunts are being proposed, no boundary changes, anything like that, just a simple increase. For elk, our statewide population estimate right now is just over 81,000 elk, which is up from 79,750 last year. And our statewide objective is 71,000. So statewide, we're probably close to 10,000 elk over objective. When we present that, a lot of times people like to know where we are over objective. And in the northern region is probably the area that we can use the most improvement on. We're about 7,000 elk over objective. Northeast region is about 2,000 elk over objective. And the rest of the state is pretty close there. And there's some challenges with getting public hunters on access to some of these areas. And depending on the unit, there's some issues with tribal issues as well, where elk are residing in areas that is difficult to get harvest. And so this is just a breakdown of where our elk populations are. If you look at permits, this year in the far column on the right, we're recommending 16,715 permits. And that is down from last year. And I know this warrants an explanation, because we just showed in the last slide that we're over objective, yet we're cutting permits. And so I think I need to explain this well, or at least attempt to. The one thing that the wildlife managers did this year that I thought was very good is they took a hard look at the hunts where they had very low success rates. And I'm talking in the teens or the single digits. And what they did is they either eliminated those hunts or severely pulled permits out of those. And what they did is they put these permits in hunts that we have generally higher success rates, so we can actually target and kill more of these animals. And another thing that they've committed to is where we've been over objective on some of these private land areas, to be more liberal with mitigation and depredation permits. And those don't necessarily show up here because they're not a public draw, but it's a way to kill elk on private land so we can grow elk on public land, if you will. And they push elk onto the public lands. And then the third thing that we're implementing is these antlerless elk control permits. And this has been proposed for several years now, and it's a very effective management tool that we have. But what it is if a hunter has an antlered permit, so a buck tag or a bull tag or a once-in-a-lifetime tag, then on select units that we have antlered assault control permits available for, they can buy a reduced cow permit. The price is reduced on these cow permits, and it's good for the same season dates and boundaries and weapon type as their buck, bull, or once-in-a-lifetime permit. And so we have three units in the state where the objective is zero: the Henry Mountains, the North Santa Fe, and portions of the San Juan Any Bull unit. And then we have nine units where it's been difficult to harvest enough antlerless elk to control the population. And so these units have been 9 Mile Range Creek, East Canyon, Chalk Creek, Morgan Southridge, South Slope Yellowstone, Wasatch Current Creek, the Aviniquin, and then new units for this year that we're proposing are the Ogden unit and the Wasatch West. With new hunts and boundary changes, we have hunts that we've had in place for a long time, and what we've done is for four units, the South Slope Yellowstone, West Daggett, Mount Dutton, and the South Manti, these are boundaries that currently exist. We're just adding an additional hunt to them, and so that way we can target elk that we need to at different times of the year. And then next there, I've broken it up into boundary and name changes. We have a couple units, the Fair and Lower and the Gordon Creek Price Canyon. These are just simply boundary extensions. If we had a pretty open winter down there, and so a lot of the elk weren't coming down to where they typically do, so those boundaries were extended higher so hunters can get to them if we have another winter like we had this year. And then the Wasatch 17 B and C, this is an area where we've had antlerless elk control permits. We had it last year, and we got a lot of good feedback from hunters on that. But one thing that they were frustrated with is the deer boundary didn't necessarily completely match the antlerless elk boundary. And so just to simplify it and make life easier on people that draw these permits, we want alignment there. And then a simple name change on the South Slope Bonanza Vernal Unit. These are new hunts that we've created and required boundaries to be altered. The Beaver Valley and Kasharam Valley, this is to target depredating elk in the southern region. The Monroe, Mount Dutton, and Plateau units, we found we were playing ping pong with these elk, where we'd hunt them on the Monroe, so they'd run to the Dutton, and then we'd hunt them on the Dutton, and they'd run back. And we just said, let's just make one unit. Hunters can go to where the elk are and get higher success rates. Chalk Creek, all these units are being combined into one this year, recommending hunts on the Ogden early, middle, and late seasons. And then the Plateau, Fish Lake, Thousand Lakes has some changes as well. For doe pronghorn permits, we're recommending decreases from 962 to 669. And then for antlerless moose permits, we're not recommending any again this year because of the lower survival rates on these animals. For new hunts and boundary changes, last time we met, we talked about the Plateau and the Cache, Morgan, Southridge, Ogden. Changing those boundaries for the buck portion, and now we just want to match the antlerless pronghorn portion to that. And then the Mount Dutton, Ponsagat, and Johns Valley is a slight alteration to preserve that small group of pronghorn on the Johns Valley unit. And that's all I have for antlerless. Thank you.
Thank you, Justin. Do we have any questions from the public on Justin's presentation? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions from the council? Jeffrey.
Seems like a silly question maybe, but the nine units that you have too many antlerless elk, what's the problem? Why, how come you can't kill enough elk on those units? Nine of them.
Yeah, there's just some challenges. A lot of them are dominated by private lands, and so on paper it looks easy to just say, well, let's throw more permits at it and we'll kill more elk. But one thing that we've found as an agency, and we've really tried to listen to our hunting public, is throwing more hunters on top of hunters isn't always necessarily the solution. And so what you can do is, in some ways, you can actually throw more hunters on each other and kill the same amount of elk or less elk in some instances. And with this, with antlerless elk control, the reason we're big on this is because you're not adding any new hunters to the field. If a guy's out there hunting his buck and he comes across an antlerless elk, he can harvest that. And it's not like we're throwing more hunters at it. And so the success rates should be better in killing more elk with less hunters. So, and again, part of it's tribal issues where elk are smart. I mean, you can train elk with hunting. And so if they go to an area and they're not hunted, that's where they're going to be. And when the hunts are over, they come out. And so we do our winter counts, and there's elk everywhere, but they weren't necessarily available to the public during the hunting season. So we're just trying to think outside the box. So,
any additional questions? Paul?
I noticed that one of those new units is the Ogden unit. What percentage of private land is in that unit? Do you have a grasp on that? The concern being that the very thing will push pretty much all the animals off public land onto private, creating more of a depredation issue.
Yeah, I'd probably need some help from the region. What portion is of the Ogden is private versus public?
Randy Wood. I'm not sure exactly, Paul, but we're probably looking at a lot, 50% of that, or
yeah,
pretty high percent private.
Thanks, Randy.
Any additional questions from the council? Do we have anyone from the public who would wish to comment on this agenda item? Okay, we'll go to the council. Comments from the council? Or motions?
I make a motion we approve the antlerless recommendations as presented.
Second.
John Wall. We have a motion from Bryce Thurgood and a second from John Wall to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the antlerless permit recommendations for 2014. Discussion on the motion? See none, we'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Thank you, Justin. We'll now go to the antlers CWMU voucher permit recommendations for 2014.
Are we going to take a break today or not?
Do you want to get finished real quick, or do you want to take a break?
I tried to get us finished with the big motion, and he caught me on it.
let's just get this finished. We have Scott, and then we have one little extra.
It wasn't a recommendation. It was just a question if we're going to have a break.
No.
The answer is no. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yay. I can make this quick for you.
Okay. Go for it.
Depends on you, though. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Regional Advisory Council. I'm Scott McFarland. I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator for the state. And tonight I will be presenting the 2014 CWMU antlerless voucher permit review and recommendations. The reason I've split this out between vouchers and permits is that the permits actually come to the CWMUs, the private part of it. They come as vouchers that are redeemed for a permit. And they come as permits through our draw process through to the public. So, just as a review here, 42 CWMU or COR have CORs that are certificate of registrations that are previously approved. All of our CWMUs are on a 3-year management plan, and the numbers for those are approved on a three-year period. Unless they want them changed. They can initiate changes on these on an annual basis. It can be initiated by the CWMU, or the division can request those also. So 9 of the CWMUs have requested changes to the previously approved numbers. And 9 CWMUs will require Wildlife Board approval for new 3-year certificate of registrations. These are the ones that went through the approval process last fall during the Bucks and Bull process, but we need to approve their antlerless numbers during the antlerless process this spring. And so in summary, all of the CWMUs statewide are requesting a total of 312 private antlerless permits and 1,224 antlerless vouchers will go to the public for a total of 1,536 of all species. Just as a matter of clarification, sometimes we get a little bit confused on how these are allocated. The antlerless vouchers, or the permit, the public-private split, is determined during the Bucks and Bull process when we do that in the fall. So, what they choose for their private-public split ratio for Bucks and Bulls determines what the antlerless split will be. For example, if they choose a 90-10 split, a private 90-10 private-public split, all of the antlerless permits that are offered for that unit go to the public. If they do an 85-15 private-public split, the 25% would go to of the antlerless permits would go to the CWMU, and 75% would go to the public through the draw. And correspondingly, if they go to an 85-15, it'd be an 80-20 would be a 40-60 split, and 75-25 would be a 50-50 split between private and public. Pronghorn and moose are always a 60-40 split. They don't have an option to change that. And that's for the bucks and bull, or for the bulls and the bucks and pronghorn and moose. Currently, we don't have any antlerless moose permits offered for the state. So I just put the pronghorn on here, and it's a 60-40 split for the bucks, and it's a 40-60 split, private-public split, for the doe antelope. I will go through the recommendations, each of the recommendations by region. We'll start with the northern region here. I won't read through the numbers. We'll just have you look at these on here, but I'll go through the recommendations of each of the CWMUs. We had most of these are renewal. The Grass Valley, Grouse Creek, Jacobs Creek Mountaintop, and Woodruff Creek CWMUs are all renewal applications. They were approved last fall for the Bucks and Bulls, and we just need approval for those for the antlerless this spring. And these are the numbers for them. Hartscrabble is a new one. It's not actually a new CWMU. It just falls into the new category because it changed ownership and they had to reapply as a new CWMU. And we recommend approval of all these numbers. There's very few changes from their previous applications. And the division recommends approval, that's a joint approval. It's a joint recommendation of approval by the CWMU and the division. It's done cooperatively. The Deseret CWMU requested changes to their three-year certificate of registration and their numbers. They asked for 100 permit decrease on their elk antlerless permits. And that's a change. And then they ask for a decrease also on their doe pronghorn permits. And these are the numbers that they had requested. We recommend approval of both of those also. The Southeast region, Minimod Ridge and Red Ranches were renewal applications. And these are the numbers for them. We recommend approval of both of these. And all these in the Southeast region will be for elk antlerless permits. Emma Park, Preston Nutter Ranch, Conover Jensen, Spring Creek Dodge, and Summit Point all requested reduction in their antlerless elk permits. These are the numbers they have requested, and the division recommends approval of these also. In Southern region, Black Point is a renewal. It's the same permits as they had in their previous application. A pronghorn CWMU, and these would be their doe pronghorn requests. And we recommend approval of that. Alton asked for a slight increase in their elk antlerless elk permits. And as a change application, we recommend approval of this one. Central Region, the Heaston and 3C are both change applications. They filed with the division for a decrease in their antlerless elk permits. And we recommend approval of both of those by the division. So as an overview, for deer, there's one CWMU in the northern region here that has deer antlerless permits, and it's in the box elder unit, and they're recommending, they've been approved for 10 two-doe permits, so it'd be a total of 20 permits for antlerless deer. On elk, for the CWMU, they're recommending 238 private permits and 1,090 public permits on elk. Antlerless prong or doe pronghorn, we're recommending 74 private permits and 124 public permits for a total of 312 on all species, 312 private permits and 1,224 public permits for antlerless. What this represents is just under 80% of all the permits, the antlerless permits, are going to the public. With that, thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Do we have any questions from the public on the presentation? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions from the council on the presentation? Jim?
Just wondered why the decrease in antlerless permits in the CWMUs, as for example at Deseret, when they're not under objective, but I realize that's not a not done the same way, but just wondered why do we recommend that they not shoot as many cows when we're trying to get rid of cows everywhere else in the northern region?
That's a good question on that. I think it does deserve some explanation, and I may have to have the region if I don't cover this completely, but for that, the Deseret is in the Morgan Southridge unit, and I believe it's been 5 or 6 years since they've had a flight to verify their counts. And so they've been relying on modeling, and there's fluctuations in that population, and Deseret has also had a change in management, and they wanted to be a little bit on the cautious side because they've been harvesting about 260, well, they've had 260 permits for the unit for several years now, and they've been harvesting about 90 to 95% of those, and they've been hitting them very, very hard. So they just wanted to back off until they got a reliable population estimate, you know, based on a not so much a reliable, but a population estimate that they base on a count to make sure that they're harvesting what they need to. So that's the explanation for that. In the southeastern region, they've had some population reductions, they felt, and the CWMUs were taking a corresponding reduction on their units also in response to that. And sometimes what happens with the CWMUs that we ask them to step up to the plate and take more permits, and so they hunt them harder. It's not like managing a 750,000 acre unit. These are 10,000 acres and is the smallest for elk, but some of them are even smaller than that are grandfathered into the program. But when you hunt them so hard, like Justin was saying, the elk learn and they go somewhere else. And so a lot of times we have to back off on those permits and wait for the population to come back in and reestablish before we start hitting them hard again. So.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any additional questions from the council? Bryce.
So, I mean, according to the permit, I mean, or the population objective, the Morgan Southridge were 3,500. I mean, objective is 3,500. We got 5,000. That ranch is, what that CWMU is, what, 250,000 acres?
I think it's 218. So
but it's got other ground in the, I mean, they've been adding ground into
sure.
that CWMU. So
that's correct.
I just have a hard time seeing that decrease because, like you say, the elk know where the, and then it seems like you're going to put more pressure because we're over objective, so you're going to put more pressure on all of the surrounding units and not pressure where it needs to be on where a bulk of the elk are.
Okay. It would probably be best for me to refer to the region on their justification on why they've decreased those permits.
To me, I mean, while he's coming up here, it might, to me, seem a lot of the reason why they want the decrease is because they don't want the hassle of more cow hunters up there because they're public. So that kind of, I'm hoping that's not the answer, because that's not...
Yeah, that's not the answer. Chad Wilson with Division of Wildlife. And mostly what it is they found over the years, Deseret's carried the bulk of our cow killing of cows for quite some time. Closer. And so what they've just seen over the years is that as they push those elk and push those elk, they're seeing less production out of those elk. And so they wanted to back off because they just feel like that they've been chasing them too hard and too much. They still, if they continue with the percentage of elk that they've killed in the past, if they kill them this year, they'll still meet their three-year management objective of what we've asked them to kill. Matter of fact, they'll probably still be above and beyond the minimum number that we've asked them to kill.
But you're still 1,500 elk above objective, yeah. And that is the biggest population of elk in that unit.
Right. And if you look at it, we have increased the total of tags from last year to this year. We're 25 more tags than what we had last year. So we have spread those out. Like I said, Deseret's been one of our best CWMUs as far as percentage-wise. And going forward, my plan is to have some of these other CWMUs in other areas actually participate a little bit more. They've kind of carried the brunt of it throughout the past few years. The surrounding CWMUs, a lot of them don't have a lot of elk tags, and their percentages are quite a bit lower. Like Scott was saying, you know, Deseret, a lot of times they're 90% success rate. They've really, really carried the brunt. And so we kind of just want to spread that around a little too. And like Scott said, we haven't flown it for quite some time. It should have been flown this last year, didn't have the conditions to do it. Hopefully we can fly that next year and get a good estimate.
Well, it just seems like, too, another thing that, you know, like you put more tags like on the Hennifer open unit, you know. Well, if there's no snow, there's no elk, you know. Or those elk know, like you say, they know right where to go. And so they're going to stay on Deseret. And so it just seems odd that you're not really targeting where they need to be targeted.
Yeah, but like I have said, we have targeted it there a lot in the past. And I'd have to go back and look at the exact numbers, but I think we've asked them to kill 550 cow elk over the 3 years. Sitting right now, they're well over 400. And they're killing over 200 cow elk every year. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm answering it any better or not, but that's kind of the direction we're going. If we fly it and we find that that's where all the elk still are, then we'll up those numbers back up to where they've been. But from every indication is that they don't have the numbers there, they don't have the production there like they used to with how hard that they've hit it, and they have dispersed them from there.
So. Jeffrey.
Might as well stay there for a second. Okay. I want to kind of expound on this because there's one thing I don't understand. The one thing I do like is that it's because it's a 90-10, they get it's all public permits. But what I'm hearing is, do they get to choose how many permits they get? Because it sounds to me like they're driving this rather than the DWR. Is this biologically based, or is this saying Deseret wants this many, so we're going to go with it because they're nice people?
No, I mean, we work together on it, and you know, we take into consideration what they're seeing and what our numbers are. So the feeling I have the feeling that they are running those elk a little bit too hard, and they're actually hurting those elk. So that's why we kind of wanted to back off there. Management-wise, objective-wise, like I said, you look at the last 3 years, we've been hanging about 5,000, which is the 1,500 over objective. But we've been kind of hanging level, and we are increasing the the amount of permits that we're giving. So we're looking at it. as trying to still manage to our objective. We have more permits. We're just kind of moving the pressure to other places and seeing if that will be more effective.
Any additional questions on the topic? Okay. We have no blue cards. Is there anyone from the public who wished to comment? Okay, we'll go to the council. Comments from the council? And or motions?
Move to approve.
Second.
John Blazer, was that? Okay. We have a motion from Lynn Nielsen and a second from John Blazer to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the antlerless CWMU voucher permit recommendations for 2014. Now, Scott, do we need to make a recommendation to them to approve the change applications and the new applications, or is that already covered in?
That should all be covered in the everything that's in the presentation.
Okay. As presented. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, Chair will call for a vote. Please raise your hand and say aye if you're in favor.
Aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. We have one other action item. Stacy's asked me to see who would be interested in only receiving their packets electronically through Dropbox. She could set you up. You could go in and look at the packets in the Dropbox. All the updates would be in there. We also keep the Wildlife Board information in there. They're just trying to look at reducing costs, I believe, mostly, paper waste. So if you're interested in receiving your packets in that way, just let me know. And I'll forward that to Stacy, and we'll get it taken care of. Jim.
So it would just be on the website as it is now?
It's also already on the division's website, but she would set you up in Dropbox so that if there were any updates, you'd see them right there, too. You could see the Wildlife Board packets. It would have their draft minutes in it, things like that.
I'd be interested in that.
Okay. But you'd only get it electronically. You wouldn't get a paper copy anymore.
Yeah, it's okay. I love trees.
That make good
so
paper.
I have a question.
Yes, Jeffrey.
So, I mean, that just basically puts the onus on us to print our own off before we come, right?
If you want to bring a paper copy, yeah. I'll probably do it, but I'll just keep bringing my laptop, so I'll just look on my laptop.
Now, just in case, I mean, I have Dropbox, and I sometimes forget to check on it, and then they have to send me an email and say, did you see the document in the Dropbox? Will she be sending out an email saying, check your Dropbox?
Well, it will probably be just like the email she sends out now that says, I've put it on the web, and it's your paper copy's coming. She'll probably just say in there, it's also already in Dropbox. I think she says that now.
Bill Bates, she'll still send you the email. Plus, if you have Dropbox, when you turn your computer on, it says that 5 files have been uploaded to Dropbox. So it tells you.
You're assuming I read that stuff.
So anyone interested in that, please send me an email. Lynn?
I'm interested.
Okay.
You can write me on there.
Bryce?
I'd do it.
Jeffrey? Joel. Okay. John Wall. Okay. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here tonight. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.